If there is anything that is made abundantly clear in this passage of the gospel, especially that second half of the reading from Luke chapter 9 that we've just heard, is that simply this, that the heart of the Christian life is to follow Christ in a personal and definitive way, that it's not simply a question in order to be a disciple, to be a Christian. It's not simply a question of subscribing to a set of propositions or to accepting a certain doctrine. That is part of the Christian faith. It's an essential part of the Christian faith because our faith has a content, right? But the foundational element of our faith is this personal response to Christ, of making a commitment to a person, not just to an idea, but making a commitment to a person and then not looking back, not doubting it. Or even if we do have doubts, which is a normal part of the pilgrimage of faith, to continue to move forward. So this gospel recounts three instances on the Lord's road to Jerusalem, where he will meet the cross, of potential disciples being called to follow Christ. And there are people who either approach him or who are invited by Christ, and we can certainly say that they possess some initiative and enthusiasm. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could echo their words, "Lord, I will follow you wherever you go." That's not an easy thing to say and to mean it. But their enthusiasm isn't enough. It's good, but it's not sufficient. Because the Lord, first of all, wants them to understand what it will cost them. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head, he tells the first potential disciple, to let him know that his enthusiasm, while good, will also have to be a wide-eyed, realistic enthusiasm that enables him to see that, yes, in order to follow Christ, I will have to give some things up, and that there can be no personal conditions, even if they are good things. I can't say, if I want to be a disciple of Christ, I will follow you, Lord, except for A, B, and C. It's as if we were presented, as the Israelites were, with the Ten Commandments and Moses coming down from the mountain and proclaiming those commandments, and we said, those are very interesting. How many do we have to do? 7 out of 10 is usually a passing grade. It's not a very good grade, but it's a passing grade. Is that enough? And Moses would crack those tablets over our noggins. And they would break because our heads would be harder than the stone on which those commandments are written. To make a commitment without any kind of compromise, without holding one back, holding anything back. And the Lord invites us, he invites you and me to that kind of commitment. And he says to this third disciple, "No one who sets a hand to the plow and looks to what was left behind is fit for the kingdom of God." You know, that should make us quake just a little bit in our boots or our sandals or whatever we're wearing, flip-flops on the beach. No one who lays a hand to the plow and looks to what was left behind is fit for the kingdom of God. Where do we see an example of this illustrated in the scriptures? One comes to mind immediately, and that's in the Exodus of the Israelites from Egypt to the Holy Land. And while Moses is on the mountain communing with God and receiving the law, the commandments which will guide and form and give identity to the people of Israel, what are they doing down in the desert? They're worshiping the golden calf. We have to admit how ridiculous it would be. You're in the sight of the mountain of God with his glory being displayed upon that mountain, and then they worship an idol made of metal. But what's interesting, I think, is to look at the symbolic nature of that act on their part. How did they fashion that golden calf? It was made from golden jewelry, amulets, bracelets, those sorts of things. Where did the Israelites get them? They took them from the Egyptians. They looted the Egyptians before, the gospel doesn't use the word looting, it would look undignified. But you know, that's kind of what they did. As they were driven out of Egypt, although Pharaoh, we know, later changed his mind, they looted the Egyptians. And as former slaves, they undoubtedly felt they had a right to do that. We won't argue the goodness of that act, but nevertheless, they brought that gold and those products of that looting with them into the desert, and it's out of that they made the golden calf. So in a certain sense, the golden calf for the Israelites at the foot of Mount Sinai, they had just crossed the Red Sea. You know, this all these events had just happened perhaps just a matter of weeks before. They fashioned this golden calf out of the jewelry they had taken from the Egyptians. And so it's an idol that really represents their attachment to Egypt, their attachment to slavery, their attachment to the yoke of Pharaoh, which to them and their circumstances in the desert looked preferable to being formed as the chosen people of God. Can't something similar happen in the life of the Christian, especially perhaps for those who may have a moment in their life when there's a 180-degree conversion? But isn't it tempting sometimes to look back and say, you know, I wish I didn't have to give up this sin. I wish I didn't have to give up this vice in order to be a disciple. That's like the tail of the golden calf flicking itself around our heart and trying to draw us back in, to have a kind of sentimental yearning for what a Christian has to give up. That's the temptation that each one of us faces or will face or has faced in our striving to be faithful disciples. And so what conclusions can we draw from this episode of the gospel? How do they apply to our life? Well, first thing we learn is discipleship is a serious matter. Not serious in the, you know, sense of, you know, kind of a dour face all the time, but serious in that it's life-changing, it's life-defining. It's a serious matter. It has consequence. We can't just kind of be a casual follower of Christ, you know. We can follow sports teams casually. Don't tell that to a rabid fan. But, you know, we can. And not be too disturbed if they lose every now and then. But we can't have that kind of casual relationship to Christ. And the second thing we learn from these encounters is that not only does discipleship require complete commitment, but Christ gets to set the terms. We don't get to say, I'll do it under these conditions. We can negotiate employment with that kind of attitude. We can say, especially if we have a skill that's in high demand, we have offers from different companies or potential employers, we can say, well, I'll come work for you if you do this, or I'll come work for you if you do that. We can set some of the terms occasionally in certain aspects of our life, but when it comes to being a Christian, it's Jesus who gets to set the terms, because it's his gift to give us. It's not ours to modify and make it more to our liking or our convenience, as the Israelites were trying to do in the desert. Because it's his gift to give, we have to receive it in its integrity. And that reception of that gift can cost us something. The Lutheran pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was martyred by the Nazis about a year before the end of World War II, wrote a book called The Cost of Discipleship. And one doesn't even have to read the book to get his point, that sometimes being a disciple of Christ will cost us, that we have to give something up. And sometimes I think for people that's frightening, but on the other hand, we look at other areas of our life where we give things up. We do it all the time. An athlete gives up his energy, he gives up his time, he gives up his preferences, he gives up his diet, maybe. Anyone who's a high school student or a college student who's playing sports, even not necessarily in an organized way, but even in a casual way, has to make certain sacrifices in order to excel. Any student has to make sacrifices in order to master and grasp the topic that's being presented to them in terms of the time they give to study. All of us have to make sacrifices in order to get up in the morning and go to work and earn a living for the benefit of our families. Huh? or to take care of the home or to do anything worthwhile requires some sacrifice. In other words, to say yes to something good means saying no to other things, even to good things. It goes without question that being a disciple of Christ means saying no to sinful things and to evil things. But sometimes it means saying no to good things. And so there will be a cost for us in discipleship, and we'll sometimes even be required to give up something that is good so that we can have something that is better, even if that difference isn't immediately discernible to us. And the perfect example of that is from that first reading, from first book of Kings, Elijah passing on his mantle literally and figuratively to Elisha, who will come after him. And Elisha's kind of like this guy, the third guy in the gospel. He said, oh, this is great, but let me tell my family goodbye. And Elijah says, oh, you're a crazy old guy. I should have chosen somebody else. Who knows what the original Hebrew says? I imagine it's pretty strong language. And so Elisha's rebuked because he still has this natural attachment to his family, right? That's a good thing. But Elijah said, you're going to be a prophet after me. You've got to give up everything, even good things, because the Lord is calling you to something better. And to his great credit, Elisha gets the message. And then what does he do? He's plowing the field with his 12 yoke of oxen. I mean, have you ever seen an ox? These are huge animals. I'm not talking about a person that we call an ox, but a real ox. They're huge. And he has a yoke of 12 oxen that he's plowing with. I mean, Elisha was a big guy. He must have been strong. How can you control these 12 beasts, you know? And he's plowing up this field. And what does he do to show his complete commitment to this, to his new vocation of being a prophet? He slaughters all the oxen, 12. That must have been a mess. Slaughters all the oxen, takes the yoke, makes a fire. He must have been at this for at least a couple days, and he broils all the oxen steaks on the fire that he has made, and he feeds them to his workers, and then he goes off. In other words, he completely closes the door to his former way of life, which was a good way of life, something that could be pleasing to God, but he was called to something more intense. And he destroyed everything and made good use of it. Didn't just leave the oxen in the field to fend for themselves. He provided his food for all of his workers. They must have been exceedingly pleased. And then he went and he followed the great prophet Elijah. And so the question we have to ask ourselves is there anything in our lives, even a good thing, is there anything in our lives that stands in the way of our being fully committed to Christ? And one of the ways we can judge that, the answer to that question, is just simply thinking about how we organize our time. What is it in our day that we put first above everything else? And for each person, it could be something different. And we should ask, well, should that be the first thing? Should that be the thing that's the center of my life and my existence? Even if it's a good thing, even if I still have to do it, should it be the center? Shouldn't my relationship with Christ, which is made evident in my prayer and my sacramental life and my works of charity, shouldn't that be the center of my life? Not necessarily to the exclusion of those things which are necessary for us and that are still good, but something that should be the center. And I think to put Christ in the center and to keep him there, we have to have a good measure of courage. The courage, certainly Elisha was a man of courage and a man of trust. And I think probably these potential disciples, we're not told what happens. Do they really follow Christ? After all, we're not really told. But they had to have courage to come up to the Lord and at least state their intention. We want to have that same courage so that fear and the love of comfort and the love of the familiar will not hold us back. Well, let us then therefore take these words to heart and ask the Lord to help us. Help us to move forward. Even if sometimes we say maybe to him, even if sometimes we say not yet, that he can change those, that he might change those into a yes, into a firm commitment to to follow him wherever he leads us, so that we will not be fixated upon the cost of discipleship, but will be rooted instead in the joy of one who follows the Lord with love and with determination and with clarity of purpose.